Hi, everybody. Welcome to Book Tales with Rand Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are delighted to feature Avital Gad-Sickman, author of Light Reflection Over Blues, published by Ravina Press.
Book Tales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? We thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a cozy idea. Today, we are drinking the Red Caipirinha Under the Bridge, inspired by Avital's book. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make it and have one with us.
As well as the book we are featuring today, Avital Gad-Sickman is the author of the flash collection Life In, Life Out, published by Matter Press. She has a PhD in English literature that focuses on women authors, gender minorities, and trauma studies. Her work has appeared in the Dr. T.J. Eckelberg Review, Iron Horse, Literary Review, Prairie Schooner, Ambit, Calyx Journal, and others. Her stories have been featured in anthologies such as W.W. Norton's Flash Fiction International, Politically Inspired Fiction, and The Best of Gigantic. She is the winner of the Margaret Atwood Studies Magazine Prize, and her flash fiction has been listed twice in Best of the Web, Wigleaf. Of Light Reflection of Blues, award-winning author Viet Dinh says, it is a, quote, stunning collection. Avital Gad-Sickman's opalescent stories had me turning over each one in my mind. With poetic condensed language, she evokes the pains of young women growing up amidst conflict in the landscape around them, as well as deep in their own hearts. Sometimes surreal, sometimes frank, but always engaging, these stories hit like smart bombs. End quote. Really strong praise.
Avital's book, Light Reflection Over Blues, is a strong collection of short prose, which includes flash and longer pieces with simple, compelling titles such as Water Memory, Islands of Salt, A Dance in Four Movements, Drawing Light, and Growth. The collection is intriguing on so many levels as it reaches deep below the reader's consciousness, poking at the mysteries there with a light touch that would seem possible for the quickening it causes.
How are you doing today, Avital?
Very well. I'm really glad to be here with you. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Oh, we're delighted to have you. And we're so looking forward to talking about your work and having you give us a reading a little bit later. Do you enjoy giving a live reading?
I'm getting used to it. I'm a little shy on stage usually, but on a podcast it's easier, I think. But also, I get the feeling now that I might like it one day.
Oh, yeah. It kind of grows on you, you know? I think there's a lot of nerves in the first couple readings, but then you start to enjoy it more maybe later.
The more you do, the more comfortable you get, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm curious where you got the idea for this collection and how did it all come together for you?
Well, I think that after I published my first collection, I started writing stories which were a bit more connected to my own experiences, and I tried to look deeper and deeper into myself as well as into other people. So it started getting a certain line of intimacy. And I think that once you get started in one direction, it takes you forward in it. You keep writing stories in this direction and get energy from the same sources and inspiration. So it's hard to say where I got every story, but it's always something that strikes a chord within me.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's so interesting that you feel like your work deepens and gets closer to you a little bit later in the trajectory. So can you tell us something about how you decided to become an author? And maybe what were you trying to write away from when you first started writing that kept you from going in that direction immediately?
Well, I decided to be a writer when I was about 10 years old after I left the ideas of being an acrobat in a circus. But
there was really a chance you were going to become an acrobat in the circus?
Oh, yeah, and I really trained very hard toward it.
Oh, but, my goodness, wow.
But then I thought that writer may be a little more suitable for me. But for years, I just wrote randomly, and I wrote mostly in Hebrew while I was living in Israel. But right. Then I moved to Brazil, and I kind of felt a little out of place, a little like the observer, and I didn't speak Portuguese very well. And then the internet entered my home, and I started chatting with people from all over the world. And I don't know, I just, again, it's something that I always like to do. So I started writing very, very short stories that today might be called flashes, and showing them to people. And they encouraged me to continue. And it sparked that light that even in my childhood I started, but I didn't follow. And once it started, it really got more energy each year and each publication. And every encouragement led me farther into it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a little even late in life. You know, I was in my late 30s, I think, when I started doing it seriously.
Wow. That's so interesting. Now, when you're drafting a book, how do you decide how to organize the stories? Like, what is your process for placing the stories and organizing them?
Well, it's also intuitive. Like in this book, I decided to make it chronological. You may notice that the first stories are about childhood, and then about teenage, and then about adulthood, and so it goes. Sometimes I took things out of context because, you know, a motive in the story was connected to the motive of another one. But usually it goes by time. It's literal in this sense.
Interesting.
I'm curious about, there's a lot of stories in this particular collection.
Yeah.
How did you know when you were done writing it? And were you organizing it all the while? Like, how did you know when the collection was done and you were satisfied with the organization?
This is a good question. A question that I consider many times. Even after I thought I was done, I suddenly decided to substitute two stories from the book. And I remember saying it to friends, and they told me, no, the editor would never allow it at this stage. But the editor, Catherine Rantala, is really a very liberal, smart person, and she took it very well. So I think it's always in the process. But yeah, there is a certain feeling. It's a feeling that it's done, that it's kind of a capsule already.
Yeah, you know how, though, when we've been writing stories for so many years and you're putting together a collection, in my experience, sometimes I write a whole collection all in one and it's done and I know it. But mm-hmm. other times, if I'm gathering things thematically or whatever, the collection will have stories from so many different periods of the writing that then it becomes like, I don't know, organized by theme or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. You know.
And then sometimes it becomes organized by how many of the pieces are published, how many are unpublished, can I do a good balance that I feel good about here, and all of that stuff. So I guess I was just curious, did you feel like this was like an all-in-one write, or did you feel like this was definitely something that was compiled from a lot of different years and impulses?
Most stories were written through 3 years, I think, one after the other. But the first story in the collection, Water Memory, was written very, very long ago. It was published in the Michigan Quarterly Review, and I always liked it very much. And once I started putting the collection together, I remembered it, and I thought, it's longer, but it's made of many mini flashes. So I thought, wow, it fits in so well, I must put it in. And I did. So most of it came together, but some stories were added this way.
Mm-hmm. You were talking a little bit about the form of flash. I'm kind of curious, because I don't write flash. I like reading it a lot. I'm curious if you would talk a little bit more about why this particular form appealed to you. And I know you write poetry as well, so I'm wondering about the connection for you between flash and poetry, or if there is one.
Yeah, well, of course there is one. And I think Heather writes both also, so she knows about this connection.
Oh, sure.
The first stories that I wrote, as I said, when the internet entered my home, were flashes, because my inner rhythm goes this way. Also, usually when I speak with people or when I walk, my husband always complains that I walk very fast. I speak fast and I walk fast, and I get to the end of the way to my goal very fast.
I like that. I'm fast also.
Uh-huh. So, you know, flash suits me very well in this aspect. And I think when I started writing in English, I wrote automatically this way. Later on, as I developed my craft, I think I saw that every story has its own length, and yeah. I don't want to limit it. And sometimes a story gets longer because I put few flashes together, write one flash after the other, but they are so connected that they must stay together, and then they become a longer story. But there is something in it, the tempo, you know, that, and the intensity. The intensity is very important to me, and once it's over, I don't want to continue because everything over it would be too much.
Oh yeah, definitely. But it's really interesting because you almost have some characteristics of a novel and stories with how a lot of the characters in this book repeat as the different timelines are moving, like Adele, Shlomo, Dana, and many of the characters, they're recurring. And that was so yeah. fun to see. So I guess I would just ask, what are your favorite types of characters to write? And were you compelled with establishing an arc in the narrative of those characters since they did appear in multiple stories?
Well, you got really the exact characters that I like. You know, these characters are based on people that were very important to me in my life, or I lost very early, or I never saw again, but they stayed with me and they developed inside me and they still live with me. So it's like in the story Mothers, for example. The mother is not my mother because my mother was not alive when I published my first book, As It Is in the Flesh. And the imaginative mother of the narrator also is not my mother because she's a product of my imagination. But these mothers have a lot from the essence of what I felt for my own. And Shlomo, I would say, also, it's the essence of what I remember from my father, with many more characteristics from many other people that I've met throughout my life. And yes, I developed a certain relationship with the characters, not only with the people that I remember, but with the characters themselves. So I always went back to them.
I like the idea of the essence of a real person coming through a character.
Yeah, although it is fictional.
Right, right.
The imagination has a lot to do with it.
I think personally, how much kind of internationality that you have in this book. I think that that's a lot of fun, don't you, Ran?
Yeah, I do too. And it seems like you've been in contact with so many writers internationally. Do you feel like the exposure to authors from different countries has changed the type of work that you write or has broadened it?
Oh, definitely. And also reading books from many countries, I feel mm-hmm. that it affects me very much. Right now, I am traveling to Paris, for example. So I'm reading.
I'm so jealous.
Come over, seeing your beautiful let's have wine.
And I want to fall into them. I want to be there so bad.
Yeah. But, you know, so I'm trying to read now French writers. And it's funny because when you read a writer from another country, there is a kind of a bridge, an intercultural bridge that you make, and suddenly you want to bring this into your own fiction.
Yes.
And then I read, I don't know, Stefan Zweig from the beginning of the century from Germany, and it brings a completely other vibe, and it all comes together. And also, in the same way, it's my friends from the United States and England and Australia, South Africa. And these are the English writers. I have also friends who write in Hebrew, and they again bring me something different. And I love traveling both in the literal and the figurative way.
I do too.
Just out of curiosity, are you reading these French authors in French?
Well, I studied French on a website for 2 years, and I came here and took a book and started reading, and I can tell you that I understand the essential.
Big ideas you're getting.
Yeah, but yeah, I hope to develop a bit my French during my stay here because it's intermediate if I look at it in a positive way, but I get to communicate.
You know, I took like 7 or 8 years of French. And at one point I decided that that was the equivalent of being a second grader in French, you know?
Yeah.
So I said, it'd be better off for me to probably find the best translations that are the closest in essence, because I think there's nuances that are really hard to grasp unless you're like a native speaker or you're quite fluent, which, you know, some people are.
No, it's true. Actually, I am going to read the same book in English in any other language later on, just to make sure that I got enough out of it.
That's a good idea.
Well, I love the element, and I'm fascinated by the story of water memory, especially for the parts that address being part of a kibbutz. So speaking of like different cultures and things like that, can you explain to listeners the cultural significance of a kibbutz in Israel?
Of course.
You know, talk to us about growing up in Israel and moving to Brazil. What are your favorite things about those places?
Okay. Well, first, kibbutz. Kibbutz nowadays has changed a lot. But the basic idea and the basic organization, it's a community where everybody is equal. Everybody works for the benefit of everybody else, and everybody gets the same salary and the same life conditions. You can say that this is the best part of socialism or even communism. Let's forget the USSR and the bad part of communism. Now, this is the beautiful aspect of communism. It's a search for justice, for social justice, and it's beautiful. Now, two generations really maintain this idea, but the third generation already started being seduced by the city and by individualism and many other things. So now it's changing toward a hybrid organization of the community. And I stayed in one for 9 months. It was quite an experience, but I discovered that I'm a city girl, or right now it's a city woman, but it's worth getting to know. Now, in Israel, I was born and I was raised there, and I have many, many dear memories. And I think that the part that I like most about Israel is the sort of friendship that people develop among them. People think, and even right, they are right to think so, that Israelis sometimes are too straightforward, too honest. And it may hurt. On the other hand, people tell you what they think and what they feel. And it's easy to become a friend of someone who is honest from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And besides, the friendship is a value, a very appreciated value in Israel. And people invest in their friends, you know, they invest time and they care. So I still maintain my childhood friend, or actually from my teenage years, I still have quite a few friends there that whenever I go to Israel, I meet again and we keep in touch, because it is very important to us.
Yeah, there's really a sense moving through your stories that it's not a disposable friend culture, like that you see mm-hmm. people winding back in and through.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Quite beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for telling us that. That was
really thank you. Now, in Brazil, it's the flow, I would say. There is spontaneity. Let's say that this is a mentality you can find easily.
Sure. And maybe what you're really actually also saying is that they're very in the moment and in the now of wherever they are. Maybe.
Yes, it's true. Very much so. Of course, the Brazilian music is the best thing in the world.
I love it. I love mm-hmm. the music. Mm-hmm. One of these days, I'm going to come visit.
Okay, let's have a beer together.
Yes, that sounds lovely.
Okay, Pirinha.
Yes. I like how we're going to visit all over the world. This sounds great to me. I think one of my favorite stories was Simple Glasses.
Yeah.
It's just beautiful. And
thank you.
As I was reading it, it felt like a poem.
Oh.
And it just felt like that to me. And so I was wondering, you talked a little bit about how a story's link could like almost make itself known to you, or it feels very natural. And so I'm curious if when you have an idea or an inspiration, how do you know if it is meant to be prose or a poem? Or is it just an instinctive thing?
Yeah. Usually I don't start writing poems. You may say that they write themselves. Well, I do in Hebrew. It's happened quite a bit in Hebrew, but not in English. Usually it would be a prose poem. Mm-hmm. Now, the poetic side is very strong in me. I love reading poetry and I connect very well to poetry. It really moves me deep. So I think it's something that bursts out of me. And maybe more in stories of this kind that are emotional, but I don't want to be sentimental. You know, I don't want to go over the top. So I think that a poem or the lyrical use gives them a certain limit, but also gives them another layer that I hope conveys this emotional sensibility.
Oh, sure. And for me, just to play devil's advocate for a second, Simple Glasses seemed very much in the flash fiction modality as opposed to a prose poem, although it's very imagistic, so I could see how Rand could have that feeling. But for me, I always know when I'm writing a poem. It doesn't become a story from a poem. It starts as a poem. And then when I'm writing a story, it just feels like it's a narrative. I don't know. And maybe that causes my poems to be more driven by formal constraints, because that's what my mind identifies as poem. Like I might write in 30 different poetic forms or something like that. I might do like a crown of sonnets, or I might do a pantoum, or, you know, sort
you
of.
You improvise within the form.
Right. Mm-hmm. So do you feel that way too? Or I might be like working on Alexandrines, or I might be doing some blank verse or something like that. But I feel like the form helps shape the narrative for a poem. Your poems are that way as well, or do you feel like you're more free flow?
No, it's not a free flow, but I think that it has a line, it has a story within it, and it has a certain tempo. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't go by a sonnet or a certain type of poetry, but it must answer something inside me that is both about form and about the story. I hope this is clear.
Yeah. And the cadences are important too, right? Maybe it's the sound impacting the choice of the break of the line too.
Definitely. And sometimes, by the way, I remember a few of your poems from very, very long ago. There was one about a girl who was walking with her toys and it hit her leg. And I remember that the senses work here. You can actually feel. So,
I don't even recall this poem, but I mean, you know, that's awesome that you remembered reading something I had written.
Oh, yes, of course. I really like it. And this is something also, right? The senses work in the poems. And sometimes there is something about language that you just feel that if you put one word in its own place alone without the line, it would give a kind of weight that stops for a pause and get you to intensify the feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a teacher and I was talking to my students. We were doing poetry and I was trying to explain to them about the weight of words in poetry and how they're different than in prose, at least from my perspective. And they just were having a very hard time wrapping their head around it. So yeah, that's really interesting. You have a lot of stories about mothers in this collection. And so I was wondering if you could speak to how the theme of motherhood or parenting features in your work, especially in this collection.
Yeah, this is a theme that has always interested me, both because of my own life, you know, because for a few years I grew up with my mother, only the two of us, and it was a very intense relationship. And when I became a mother, you know, something just bloomed out of me. At the university, I was even surprised to see that nowadays everybody deconstruct the idea of a warm, supportive motherhood. The trend is to find the raw feelings of anger and of boredom. And of course, I had all of this. Everybody has.
Yeah.
But I felt that it involved a kind of growth also. And when you compare the relationships of you and your mother, and you and your daughter and your son, and then you look around you and you see that motherhood can be so many things and can take place in so many ways, and sometimes where there are the best intentions and they just go wrong, and sometimes people that don't seem to really think a lot about it just seem to be happy together. So yeah, it's both intellectually, I think, and emotionally, it's something that I still work on understanding.
Oh, sure.
Same. Me too. Very much so. I have a son and he's 22 and I contemplate this often.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. But let's not underestimate the power of the father narrative in this collection too. I mean, like we spoke about Simple Glasses earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some really interesting commentaries going on about sex and gender with women and men in this collection, and also the role of the child with the male parent, the role of the child with the female parent. Did you feel like there were certain things you wanted to bring out about fathers? Let's go with fathers.
Well, yeah, because, you know, I got to know this generation of parents where theoretically the mother raised the children and took care of the house, and the father was supposed to be at work and dealing with the accounts and whatever. And there was a binarism of roles, right? Of men and women.
Oh.
And I know that it existed, yes. But because people are people, and even if they are bound within the limits of gender and what society expects them to do, they deal with their children and with each other from their personality. And this is what interests me. You know, when you're pressured by everyone else to be this and that, but it just doesn't suit you and you go out of it. So this is where the father here for me is a man that has to be the classic man, but he's giving much more from himself to the daughter. Yeah, here it's usually daughter, right?
Oh, for sure.
Much more than expected, and maybe too much according to society around him.
Sure, and then we're introduced to his foibles later as the people in the stories mature.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's a particularly interesting lens to view the younger section through as some of the characters age too. How we, when we are children, don't see the flaws of adults, but then
mm-hmm.
we start to see what really shaped them and their real histories and maybe facts we didn't know about them, and that creates a whole new interpretation, right? I see that in several of your stories. So I'm wondering if that's something you work with too.
Yeah, actually, again, this is, you know, that my own parents were survivors of the Holocaust. My father more than my mother, but she too, her family fell away and split, and they lost many people. So, and it was in Israel at the time. We were the second generation, me and many, many of my friends. And as children, we felt this shadow.
Mm-hmm.
But we couldn't interpret it because most people, most survivors, did not share their experiences and their feelings, what happened exactly. And we didn't even try to guess because we were very busy trying to become strong Israelis with our own identity, with no influences of the past and stuff. But as I grew up, and again, many of my generation grew up, we started understanding that many characteristics of our parents and of our life stories were very strongly influenced by what the parents went through in their past, in their history. And you suddenly also see, you know, when you're angry with your parents or when you simply don't understand, but suddenly you have this wider angle, the angle gets wider the more you mature yourself. And then you have to look at yourself and say, why was I angry? How come I couldn't perceive the weight of the past on their lives? How could they blame them for anything? You know, just look at what they came out from. So yes, this is another. The history and trauma and the way it affects the generations interests me a lot. And I'm really glad that it transmitted through the stories. Thank you for noticing it.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, I really found it moving in this book, the way war, family, the army, the Holocaust moved through through many of the pieces and also the war-related trauma you're talking about, intergenerational awareness, the softening of one's perspective when one has a wider lens, all of these things were definitely coming through. It really reminded me of, there's this Israeli author I love, and his name is Edgar Keret. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Of course, yes.
Oh, I love him. Love him so much.
Yeah, he's really good.
I know. I even asked him. He said if he has a new book, he might come onto this podcast. How fun is that?
Wow, wonderful.
I know, because he's amazing. I've been reading his book for years. He actually originally wrote most of his work in Hebrew. So I was going to ask you if you wrote your work in Hebrew first, but now you've told us that you wrote the earlier parts of it in Hebrew and then kind of transitioned to writing in English.
Yeah. It was my window to the world.
Yeah, for sure. And I actually have felt quite sad sometimes that I don't read in Hebrew, because I would have liked to have experienced his work in its, you know, primary language. But when I was reading your work, and when I'm reading these themes coming through, they were really bringing his early work back to me, because a lot of these things are moving through it as well. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering, do you think as an Israeli that war shapes the identity as a writer or the view of humanity somewhat? Do you think that coming from that country is creating the need for your work to speak to these themes, which it does very well?
Yeah, well, it obviously affects all of us, everybody who grows there, and people who are raising children there really have to struggle a lot between their individual love for their children and their love for the country, this collective responsibility. And there are so many good Israeli writers, and there are so many styles that you would think that it's almost impossible to find this line that goes through all this work. But usually, if there is such a line, it would be conflict. You know, conflict in many ways. And many times it includes the army and war and nationality, how people deal with it. Yeah, it's a very complex situation. So, of course, it enters every work of art.
Right. Well, anytime something very serious enters your life or is a recurrent theme, it seems like it's going to somehow come in, even if it's not coming in the exact way it entered the life itself. Mm-hmm. That makes any sense, right? So interesting. Yeah. I'm so cool. I'm so glad you're a fan of his as well. Have you read all of his short fiction as well?
Oh, yeah. I read him in Hebrew. What I haven't read is his last book that he wrote in English. I don't remember. We had some reason to write it only in English, I think, to get some distance to be able to write it, which is something that I understand. I really like writing in English because it gives me a perspective. It gives me a bit of distance in order to get this lens of everything that I hope contains many, many aspects and elements of what I'm trying to speak about. I could interview him together with you. I would love it.
Well, it might have been one of those throwaway promises where they're like, yeah, sure, when that happens, fine. But I always thought, I'm going to bug him again the minute I see a new book out. I'm going to see what.
I want to come back and talk about form a little bit. You've been so widely published in short fiction and flash fiction, and you talked about earlier the appeal of flash fiction and the intensity, and that you're fast in so many things. But I was curious over the years if you've ever considered working on a novel or something longer, if that has crossed your mind.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I have a novel that is complete, really, and I'm supposed to try to send it to agents and stuff, and I'm gearing up for that.
That's so exhausting.
Yeah, this is the hard part. Yes. But there is another one that's in the works that I'm really excited about, that I think I should really get to work right away, because it speaks about the COVID times and solitude and things that happened during this time. For example, domestic violence grew very high, very seriously during this time. And I'm trying in this novel to show these things, but, you know, from 7 different points of view, and to try to use not only the drama, drama and the conflict of this time, but also certain humor, and to give there a bit of a confusion of who is saying the truth and what is the truth, you know, when you speak about relationships. So it's a novel that it's not easy to write, but I have the first draft, and I think it would be a very interesting experience. By the way, this novel started as flashes in a Roman zoetrope I'm part of. It's called Hot Pants and Kimchi.
Oh, yeah.
Really, in this room, we tried for a while to write a flash a day. This is a craziness, so it never happened. But sometimes it gives you a good push, you know, when you write like 5 flashes a week and all of them are connected, and you suddenly see a story and it opens up, and then in my case, it became a novel.
Oh. Interesting.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the editing process? Do you find editing and revising to be easy or hard, or what do you like or not like about it?
I like editing as I go, because if I don't edit, as many writers do, right? They write the first draft and only then they look back. I just cannot do it because it turns my stomach.
I am with you on that. I feel the same exact way.
Uh-huh. So, you know, sometimes things take me ages because I go back and back until I'm more or less happy with what I have. And then, you know, in the end, when I go into the second, third, fourth, fifth draft, I may even cut it out or work on it again. But at least at the moment, I know that it won't be very hard to read later on. I would not feel ashamed. And then I have a good friend with whom I exchanged text in the past 2 years, and he really helps me a lot because he's into cutting the unnecessary. And sometimes it's really good to have a good surgeon look at your stuff. And then, of course, I take what I agree with and I don't take what I'm not. And there are stages. There are stages where I feel that I cannot look at the work anymore, that I have to leave it and that's it. And then there are stages that all I want to do is just the whole day long, just work on it and get it right. So it's hard to give a very clear question, you know, of yes and no.
Yeah, for sure. And I'm sure different pieces have different editing needs too. Some probably come out almost fully formed, and others you seem to be fooling with for years until you maybe like them and maybe not.
It's true. And when you have many characters, you want every one of them to be a round character and not a caricature. So this is something, dialogues are fun. I love writing dialogues, you know, entering under people's skin and try to communicate with other people. But also, again, I always have to take care not to say the expected and the cliche and something, you know. Okay, so he's a cruel, violent man, so he would be cruel and violent in every aspect of his life, because he won't. We know it, right? Everyone has many sides. So it's an interesting process.
Fascinating. Well, we're looking forward to hearing you read an excerpt from Light Reflection Over Blues. But before we do that, let's have Rand tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Mm.
Today's booktail cocktail is called a Red Caipirinha Under the Bridge. The recipe is on the blog if you'd like to make it and enjoy it while you listen at home. Here are the ingredients. 1/2 a lime, 2 strawberries, 1 tablespoon of granulated sugar, and 2.5 ounces of cachaca. You can also substitute vodka. And ice. First, you place the ice in a glass, pour in the cachaca, squeeze the lime juice in, and then separately, you destem and slice the strawberries. You muddle the sugar and the strawberries together, and then you add that into the alcohol and stir. Garnish with a lime or strawberry slice.
Wonderful. It's super delicious. And I have to tell you, the strawberries are really exciting as a new feature in it, because they're very tasty when you get to the bottom of your cocktail.
Ooh, I bet.
Avital, would you tell us a little bit about the passage you'll be reading for us today?
Okay, so the first story would be Simple Glasses, which Rain mentioned, and it speaks about a father and a daughter, and I think it would speak for itself, as I'll read it. The second one I mentioned, it's Mother, that there is a bit of metafiction in it, a bit of humor, but also the thought about relationships between mothers and daughters and artists and the people she writes about. And if we still have time, there is The Country Crawls Into Me and Take Hold of My Heart and Kidneys, which speaks about the hard, complex feelings in relation to Israel.
Great, take it away.
Okay, I'll start with Simple Glasses. Last week, after the first rain, I almost stepped on a shamrock while taking a shortcut to the bus station through an open field. A rich scent emanated from the damp soil with something like anticipation, blistered with bubbles. I was tempted, but did not pluck the clover, because back in field that miraculously survived the intense construction of ugly buildings in our neighborhood, you told me not to. You and I squatted beside the little plant, the father and the child, and you squeezed your eyes behind your eyeglasses as you studied the shamrock and told me it is an Irish sign, and if it had four leaves, it would also mean good luck. We observed the vegetation together. I don't see any four-leafed ones, I said. Here, take my eyeglasses, he said. You tucked them behind my ears and pressed them against the bridge of my nose. The world blurred, and my knees buckled from dizziness, just as they did when I fell once and suffered a concussion, and you came running to pick me up. I couldn't tell whether I saw three or four leaves. I don't see how many, I said, laughing awkwardly. So you must be looking at a four-leaf shamrock, you said. Now let's go and buy a bagel at Baruch's kiosk, and I'll have a strong black coffee. We drink such coffee in simple glasses every day now. You in my dreams and me at home. Your eyeglasses serve us both, although I have my own. The melon I see is the sweetest. My love is the most beautiful. A shamrock always grows with four leaves. Okay, now to Mothers. My mother and I like reading side by side on the couch in her living room. That Friday, however, I found it hard to concentrate. She kept reading my debut novel without saying a word or lifting her eyes from the book. Only when the sound of a dress brushing against the door and the clacking of high-heeled sandals broke the silence did she look up. "Hello?" she said. I was speechless. You should have told me you'd invite someone, she whispered. There's nothing in the house to eat. Which was, of course, untrue. The woman stepped in, her large green eyes set in an oval face made beautiful by high cheekbones, took us in with ironic interest. Her Chanel suit seemed out of place in the relaxed, informal atmosphere of home. My mother got up, slow to straighten, as the woman stepped forward in an elegant, determined manner. "Ma'am, this is Mother, the narrator's mother from my novel." "Really?" My mother wrapped her robe around her own slender body, tying it in a way that disguised her small, though undeniable, belly. "I'm Mother," the woman confirmed, extending her hand. "Why does she speak with a French accent?" my mother whispered, as if Mother couldn't hear her. "Let's sit," I said. "I was born in France," Mother explained, shaking hands with Mom. "Right," I said. "You mean Austria," my mother said, smiling and pulling her hand out of Mother's firm grip. "Then we fled to England during the war. England, the Queensland, Mother confirmed. I did try to take her back there, my mother complained. They looked at me with two similar sets of eyes. Mother's eyes were greener, actually. It's fiction, I said. Fiction, right, my mother snorted. They smiled at each other. I didn't mean to interrupt your comfortable afternoon, Mother said, conveying the place, her gaze condemning the chaos of books, pillows, and sandals. Are you a widow too? My mother asked. I didn't get that to her 12th birthday in the book. It's not an autobiography or even a fictionalized one, I said. Mother shot a sharp glance by way of saying, I am nobody's fool. But my mother seemed sad. Are you so keen on looks you had to create for yourself a better looking mother? She asked. You're beautiful, Mom, I said, close to tears. Does she like reading at all? My mother whispered to me. Why don't we all sit down? I said. They kept standing, glaring at each other. How can I not be interested in culture? Aren't we the daughter of a literature professor and a ballerina? Mother said. My mother couldn't help but giggle. Daddy and Mommy would have been proud. Her wit had sustained me through everything. I wish she made Mom the professor, Mother observed. A feminist, my mother cried out. Who'd have thought? Now give me a kiss, Vitale. Mother stepped forward, backward. Have I disappointed you? My mother asked. Hardly. Mother crossed her arms around herself, confirming her own beauty. Let's sit, I said. Okay, and now if there is time for another, I will read, The country crawls into me and takes hold of my heart and kidneys. On the right, I see it. On the left, I see it. This is my country, my city, my street. A pregnant woman is walking ahead of me, right into Yehuda's camp open market. She's going to give birth to a lasso. She's going to throw the lasso across the corridor. She's going to send tomatoes and apples whistling into the air before the rope rolls around my neck. Lower your voice, the policeman tells me. Believe me, I tell the policeman, this woman is crazy. She's going to strangle me. You should be ashamed of yourself, he says. I am. I should never have been born here. I follow the woman as if I have to. Apples, tomatoes, of course, I have to. Needles rise behind me from the pavement and the drains. My feet are covered by blisters, the size and shape of capers. They are salty as well. I have been walking for thousands of years. These are nails, not needles, the policeman says. We have wood and bricks and sand and concrete. They serve to build the country. Look at her, I say. Just look at the irresponsible woman. I nestle my own baby in a hammock inside my belly. Nobody will give birth now or ever. No and no and no and no. I follow in her footsteps. Ahead of me, I see her. Behind me, I see her. She is pricked by thorns, stung by needles, riven by spikes. Where is the way? I asked the policeman. The woman's eyes hit mine like stones. I don't understand why you're always so sad, my man keeps saying. The policeman tattoos the city map over my back. She swirls around. The rope rubs against my skin like a lover. Don't get lost, he tells me.
Thank you so much. What compelling pieces.
That was wonderful. I loved hearing you read.
Yeah, thank you. I know that my accent is nothing native.
No, it's lovely. It's fun. I enjoyed hearing every word of it.
Thank you. By the way, can I only tell you a little about the illustrations in the book?
Yes.
Sure.
Okay, so Israeli artist Revital Lessig, she's a great painter, I think. And I felt when I saw her pictures that they had the same climate of someone who knew pain and loss, but always is having light and hope in life, you know, that she has in her paintings and every illustration she has here. The few layers of one's life, the very many aspects of emotion. So I felt that it just, you know, it combined perfectly with the book. And I asked my editor, Catherine, to include it. And to my great delight, she agreed.
That's great. And I'm so glad you told us that. We have a couple more questions for you. One of them is, what have you learned on your path to becoming an author? And what advice would you offer to new writers?
What have I learned in my life as a writer? You know that you have to look at everything again and again and understand that things are always changing and there is always something new you can perceive. Now, this is on the theoretical side. There is also the writing market, which I must mention because it's crazy and tough and it teaches you a lot about rejection and acceptance and what they mean, and that you cannot hold on to your situation as a published writer, just as you can't hold on to your situation as your unpublished author, because this may change also. And to new writers, I would say just read poetry, read short stories, read novels, read everything you can put your hand on, because you will learn from everything and some things will just drop or drip into your own writing without any intention and they will enrich it. I keep doing it and I hope to always keep doing it. I read like crazy all the time and I just want the world to influence me all the time and then give my own mark, because I don't think I can mark the world or the situations or people without observing and listening and reading and writing carefully as much as I can.
Oh, for sure. And sometimes I think doing that much reading that you're talking about tells you what you're writing toward, but also what you're writing against, which is really valuable when you're generating work, right?
Very true. Yeah, of course, you cannot like everything you write, but then you will understand what you don't like or what you don't like to have in your own writing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I have one last question for you today.
Yeah.
And that is, if you had to pick one moment, just one, a favorite moment in your writing life so far or your writing experience, what would that moment be?
Wow, this is a hard question.
We don't let you off easy at the end of this.
And it's the last question. Do you think it's fair? I must say, well, when I started writing in English and I saw that people liked it, it brought out of me so much enthusiasm and hope and fire. I couldn't stop writing. So I have to mention this moment. The beginning of being a writer, it involved so much fire that it's hard to describe. So for the first year, I think, was incredible. But also, I must say that now, after writing this book, the moment that I sensed that it was complete, the process of its publication was very complicated. It was accepted by university press. They told me that it was, you know, chosen out of over 1,000 scripts. So I was feeling up in the sky, and then they lost their budget, and I had to look for another press.
Oh, no.
Yeah, no, it was really very hard. And then it was just a miracle that Ravina, which is really a very good quality selective press, embraced the project. So, you know, the moment I got the books at home, I even have a video of it. And I opened this box and I saw my book in it. with these incredible illustrations by Revital. And it was there, you know, my stories in print in the world. So I don't think I had such a happy moment in many years. Except, of course, you know, giving birth and stuff. I'm not speaking about this. And my husband, you know, I'm speaking about the writing life.
Yes.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And also just thank you so much for being here today.
That was wonderful. We really, really appreciate it and enjoy talking with you so much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And I enjoyed it a great deal. And I look forward to hearing it. And yeah, let's keep in touch. I loved speaking with you.
Absolutely. Well, everybody, please order Avital's book, Light Reflection Over Blues, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the book tales, readings, and drinks. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversations with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Book Tales. See you next time.